I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. When he first ran for president, Barack Obama said he wanted to close the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. One of the first things he did after taking office in January 2009 was to order its closure within the year. Last week, the president renewed that pledge, saying the facility had become a symbol around the world for an America that flouts the rule of law. He laid out a plan to transfer 56 prisoners to Yemen and address the future of the remaining 110 prisoners. Many prisoners are on a hunger strike at Guantanamo, protesting their detention. Some of them are being force-fed. So today on Radio Time, should Guantanamo be closed? And what does the future hold for those who have been detained there? And we have two guests. Karen Greenberg is an expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University, wrote a book called The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days. Karen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me back.
Also with us is Cully Stimson, manager of the National Security Law Program and a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And Cully Stimson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty, and hello, Karen.
Hi, Cully.
In fact, we had you two on together a couple of years ago. Karen, let me begin with you. Does the president have the executive power, authority to just close Guantanamo and let Congress and I guess the rest of the country try to figure out what to do?
He has less power to do it now than he did when he started out, when he made that executive order to close it, promising to close it within a year on his first day as president. Because since then, Congress has passed a number of resolutions that have made it very difficult and impossible to move some of those detainees or any of those detainees at this point to the United States. So there are things he can do, like lift the ban on Yemen, as you referred to in your opening remarks, but he can't unilaterally close it. He can make incremental efforts in that direction. He can provide some leadership. He can move people to other countries. But in terms of bringing them here, that's going to be more complicated at this point.
How do you see it, Cully?
I don't disagree with Karen at all, although I have a little bit different take, and that is that, yes, he had more core executive power in his first couple years in office when I think he had the biggest window of opportunity to close it. But here, if the Secretary of Defense, setting aside the Yemeni detainees who he can I think, with dispatch and some thought, transfer them back to Yemen, he can direct the Secretary of Defense to give full consideration to whether it's in the national security interest of the United States to transfer these folks, give Congress the notification that's required under the law, and then simply transfer a good number of them. Whether that will be politically sustainable is an open question. But I think he doesn't have to bring them to the United States to close Guantanamo, I think is my point to Karen's point.
Well, what are the political risks, as you see it, Cully? And then I'll put the same question to you, Karen.
Well, there is no such thing as a risk-free transfer from any prison here in the United States or from Guantanamo. And I think for those who live in an absolutist world that's not realistic, that think that if, you know, any person goes back to combatant activities, that's not worth transferring them. That's not the world we live in. I mean, there are people who come out of the Philadelphia City Jail who go back to criminal activity, and there are going to be people from Guantanamo and other places of detention who will go back to other bad activities. Many others will not. And so I think that some of the restrictions that have been put in place are very unfortunate and have hampered not only this president but future presidents if it were continue to be open.
Your thoughts, Karen, and obviously there's no risk-free release, as Cully said, from any prison or any detention facility.
Right. So the United States, in terms of terrorism, al-Qaeda-related terrorism, international terrorism, has zero risk tolerance. And our leaders have accepted this and have refused to lead the country to what I would consider a more sustainable way of viewing the world. I want to ask Cully something,
sure.
Which is that I understand about transferring the detainees, but what about the ones they want to try? Would you say just transfer them and and don't try them, if that's what it means to close Guantanamo, because there's still the issue of closing it and what to do with the three dozen they want to try, in addition to the high-value detainees, such as the 9/11 defendants that they're trying now. Mm-hmm.
It's a great question.
Go ahead, and
I think the most interesting part of the president's speech last week was announcing that he was directing DOD to find a location in the United States to hold military commissions, which I think was the biggest news of the day. I think a lot of the other parts of the speech were aspirational, important, but aspirational in some senses, or recommitting himself to his original commitment. But I don't see at least any movement towards bringing the 9/11 case or the ongoing military commissions cases to the United States, which would, of course, solve part of the question that you put to me. And I think that there's a handful of people who can't be tried in military commissions. The Obama administration looked, and they can't try them in federal court. But I think the Obama administration has decided that they can't, at this point, transfer them because they deem them too dangerous. So I think that that is really the hardest of the hard cases there.
Well, let me pick up on that and toss to you, Karen, because I know that you have been to federal court in New York to observe some of these trials. Is there a place for military commissions going forward?
Oh, that's a hard one. I think at this point, realistically, although I would favor the federal court system for many reasons, there may be individuals picked up around the world in a war context, and that's why the authorizations for war and the definition of the enemy in wartime is so important, that may in the future go to military commissions. But let me say that in the past 6 months, without anybody really knowing, more than a dozen detainees, individuals, have been brought to the United States for trial in federal court here in Manhattan and in Brooklyn. And so one of the things that the president did not mention, but that he's obviously doing, is reinvigorating the federal court system to try these cases. So those are future-oriented cases. The question of whether they could roll in the three dozen that are presumed to be tried at Guantanamo would be another story. But the military commissions, and Cully, I'd love you to weigh in on this. The nicest thing you can say about them is that they are struggling to even get started. No one's been tried for 9/11. It's how many years later? Mm. And the military commissions never have been and don't seem to be a viable process in anything more than theory. They may eventually happen, but at this point, they're shameful no matter what happens, I would say.
Well, and let me just add to this, and then, Cully, I'd like to get your response. I was reading that something like 509 terror cases have been tried in federal courts over the last 12 years, almost 12 years, since September 11th. I think I read this in the New York Times, with an 89% conviction rate. When you look at the military commissions, it's vastly different results. What do you make of that?
Well, you heard of these wacky people called birthers. I'm a bother. I actually strongly support federal courts as a former...
Never heard of a bother, but yeah, go ahead.
I'm a bother. I also support military commissions because military commissions play a vital but narrow role in the arsenal that a commander-in-chief has in any wartime. And so that number that you read in the New York Times, which actually comes from an excellent written report by Human Rights First, by two guys with the last names of Zabel and Benjamin. But what you have to look at when you look under the numbers, Marty, is that those eligible even for military commissions is a much narrower class than those who would be eligible for any federal court trial, especially a terrorism trial. So, for example, we're only talking about non-citizens who violate the law of war, and then they have to fit into the narrow definition of that. So if you look at apples to apples versus apples to oranges, which is the 494 to 8 commissions cases, you really see that only a handful of people were eligible for both military commissions and federal courts. That doesn't take away from Karen's point that there's been glacial movement in military commissions. But what I would say is that because of the not only 2006 Military Commissions Act, but more importantly, the key reforms in the 2009 Act, which Obama and his team put forward, and I think they were right to do that. We have a set of laws now that, in my opinion, are fairer than international tribunals, and we don't judge justice on speed. We judge it on outcome, and I think people should withhold judgment. And frankly, if you compare the rules as I have, rule by rule, because that's what all a court system is, our rules and military commissions under the 2009 Act are fairer than any international tribunals.
Do you agree with that, Karen?
Well, I wouldn't say that you judge on outcome and not on speed. I think it's more complicated than that. I think that having an outcome, having a trial, and having a result, a verdict, is extremely important. And, you know, but if you say by outcome, you assume that it has to be a conviction, which is really how this whole process of getting military commission started. Some sense that within the federal system, these people wouldn't be convicted. Yes, there's always a risk in a criminal trial, if it's done right, that a defendant could be acquitted. It's very unlikely that a terrorism suspect would be acquitted. That hasn't happened for the most part in these cases. You say an 89% conviction rate, but if you actually look into those cases, you'll see that in any serious terrorism charges of somebody who tried to actually bomb Herald Square or Times Square or wherever else, they are getting long, often life verdicts. And they are in Colorado or some other prison, and they'll spend the remainder of their years there. So I think the outcome is important, but I do think the speed is important. We have no idea of the timeline of these military commissions.
Well, let me, I'm looking at the clock here. Cully, let me toss this to you, which is just looking back over both under President Bush and President Obama, is most of the prisoners held in Guantanamo Bay have been released. We're talking about the 166 that currently remain. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's just important, Marty, to differentiate between the term release, which simply means bye-bye, go home, and transfer, which means sending them to a home country or a third country with an agreement that that country would mitigate the threat that they would pose. So early on, releases happened within weeks of detainees getting to Guantanamo and early months, and then mainly transfers happened after that. But you're right.
Well, and Karen, is there something unique about the 166 that remain?
Well, what's unique about them is the high percentage of Yemenis involved, both in those who have been cleared for release, 56 of the 86, I believe, who have been cleared for release and transfer are Yemenis, and a number of the other ones who will be kept in indefinite detention are Yemenis as well. And so that's I think probably close to 80. And it's been an issue since the opening of Guantanamo. It remains an issue now what to do with those individuals.
And that's Karen Greenberg. She's director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University. Also with us is Cully Stimson, manager of the National Security Law Program and senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. We are talking about Guantanamo, the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Last week, a president said once again it was time to close the facility. We're talking about what that would entail and what the future holds for the terror suspects, the prisoners being held there. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Penn Museum in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Black Bodies and Propaganda, The Art of the War Poster, opens at the Penn Museum Sunday, June 2nd. Dr. Takufu Zuberi, Penn professor and host of PBS's History Detectives television series, has collected a set of historic posters aimed at mobilizing Africans and African Americans in war efforts, even as they faced oppression at home. Details on the new exhibition and opening day program online at penn.museum.
This week on This American Life, Starley and Robin were getting to be friends. But you know how it is. People are busy, so little time to talk, explain your past. So Robin switched to Plan B.
Okay.
She made Starley a tape.
What I'm going to do for you today is an ex-boyfriend montage.
Stories about Plan B's of all sorts. Or is that Plans B of all sorts? This week.
Like a buzzword, like sex.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. Deepak and Sanjeev Chopra both followed in their father's footsteps and became doctors, but one chose Western medicine and the other took a spiritual approach. Now they've teamed up for a memoir.
They say if you have a near-death experience, your life flashes back. Well, we could sort of achieve this without dying.
Deepak and Sanjeev Chopra talk about their new book, Brotherhood, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Cully Stimson and Karen Greenberg about the future of the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and its 166 prisoners, something the president talked about last week. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Neil from media to join our conversation. Neil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks. Hi, Marty.
You're welcome.
I just wonder, has there been any serious proposal, either in Congress or by the administration, to create an entirely new system to deal with terrorists? In my view, they're not really criminals who can be tried under the traditional criminal justice system. They're not really a military force that can be dealt with under military law. They're a new thing, and we're using the old rules to try to deal with a new thing. Is anybody proposing something like that?
Neil, it's a great question, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. Karen, I heard you take a breath. Go ahead. And then I'll toss it to you, Cully.
Well, I was breathing, too.
I know you were breathing, too, but go ahead, Karen. I heard her breath first. Go ahead.
There has been a proposal put forward, I believe, for the first time by Neil Katyal and Jack Goldsmith many years ago, for a separate court, kind of like the FISA court, but a separate court that would be a terrorism court that would hear these terrorism cases. And one of the reasons are evidentiary standards. But I think your contention that we're trying an unconventional enemy with conventional means may not really understand the nature of what the federal court system has done in the past, which is to try these crimes, to try them successfully, to bring them to conclusion. And we have a number of high-ranking terrorists in American prisons now from cases that took place before 2001. So I'm not sure you're right, although I think that we've gotten ourselves into such a twist about this that may someday happen. It does seem that the federal courts are able to handle these. And so I guess the question would be, why create yet another new system when they are proceeding apace? What is it we're losing? And maybe Cully can talk to
sure.
that.
Sure. Go ahead, Cully.
Well, it's a good question. Karen's right. There was a proposal by Jack and Neil. There's actually a book by a Coast Guard law professor who wrote about a new national security court. I don't think we need new courts. Military commissions are, whether you agree with them or not, are part of the fabric of the federal judiciary during wartime, and our federal courts are more than adequate, in fact, quite good at handling these cases. And I did pull the data of the 494 figure. When you peel back and look at them, 67 were folks captured overseas and convicted for terrorism-related offenses, but only 27 were associated with al-Qaeda. And when you peel that down, it's 11 federal court convictions involving non-U.S. citizens associated with al-Qaeda or its affiliated so-called DOJ Category 1 offenses, which could be tried and commissioned. So that's the apple-to-apple comparison. But I don't think we need a national security law court.
Let me quote something that the president said last week. He said, our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue, but this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. It's what our democracy demands. And, Cully, if I can toss this back to you, I mean, maybe even from a legal perspective, can mm-hmm. you pursue terrorists and end the war on terrorism?
Well, in theory, sure. And I think the president is stating somewhat of the obvious, and that is that, you know, both the Bush and Obama administrations have enjoyed some success in certainly dismantling core al-Qaeda. But what we've seen also as a result of that is a splintering of these forces. And frankly, the war that al-Qaeda launched against us started before 9/11, and we joined it as a war effort on 9/11. And I don't think it's completely up to us. I do think, however, as a legal point, And there was a hearing 2 weeks ago before the full Senate Armed Services Committee on the authorization for use of military force, which I participated in.
Mm-hmm.
There will come a point in time where the authorization for use of military force, which was limited to those responsible for 9/11 or who aided and abetted or harbored them, will lose its legal teeth. And then what do you do? And I think at the end of the war, as at the end of any war, you end detention operations, you have to release people, there's a wind-down period, and you have to stop using the legislative authorities that are provided in the AUMF.
Well, it sounds like, Karen, that that's what the president was at least beginning to propose last week, which is to sort of revisit this authorization.
Yeah, there's no question that the president, following, I think, the general counsel, the former general counsel of the Pentagon, Jay Johnson, who spoke to this point, surprising many, earlier this year, that the president would like to bring this conflict to a close, to a point where it can be managed. And very much he's speaking to an issue that's underlying this conversation, is where do we draw the line between war and crime? And subtly in some ways and more directly in other ways, mm-hmm. he's trying to move this more towards the crime paradigm, which doesn't mean that there won't be outliers. But the authorization for the use of military force is using up a lot of political capital right now. What is going to happen? Is it going to be narrowed to be specifically al-Qaeda? Is it going to be people who have an ideology that's shared with al-Qaeda? Exactly what is this going to mean? Because right now the country is fighting a war supposedly under not just the authorization for the use of military force, but what has been a creeping expansion to include associated forces. And so the use of targeted killing missions, for example, in Pakistan, in Somalia, in Mali, etc., in Yemen. Now, what is going to authorize those, and how is this all going to play out in the future, is involved with the Guantanamo conversation.
Well, and Cully, I've even heard some people say that we should treat some of these terrorist organizations like organized crime, you know, mm-hmm. treat them like the mafia or some mm-hmm. version of the mafia and deal with their potential threat that way.
Yeah, and what was, and I don't disagree with Karen's comments at all. In fact, I agree with them. The interesting thing about the president's speech last week is that his own administration, his acting general counsel for the Department of Defense, the chairman's legal counsel, and an assistant secretary of defense, the week before, in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said the authorization for use of military force provided them all the authority they needed, and they saw the conflict lasting for a long period of time. In fact, one person's opinion, the assistant secretary of defense, was that it was going to take decades, which I think you could hear the gasps in the room when that was said. And it seemed that the president was not undercutting, but putting a different take on that. So I think that you're going to see a fight, perhaps. Maybe we won't see it, but it's within the administration. For those who want to rely more and more heavily on counterterrorism, intelligence, and other activities, including the Patriot Act, FISA, and then those who will continue to push to use more conventional wartime authorities like drone strikes and boots on the ground and other activities. And I think this is what the end of a war looks like. I just think this is exactly what it looks like.
And that's Cully Stimson joining us along with Karen Greenberg. We're talking about the future of the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the future of the 166 prisoners who are being detained there. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Before we go back to our callers, Karen, I'd like to ask you something. You wrote recently, this is 5 Myths about Guantanamo. Myth number 3, Guantanamo detainees have been treated more harshly than inmates in federal prisons. You write, until the recent confrontations between guards and prisoners, Guantanamo held most of its detainees in relatively lenient conditions, especially compared with federal prisons. Then I read on Sunday, Joe Nocera had a piece, apparently lawyers representing some of these Guantanamo detainees talk about body and cavity searches every time they have to meet with their client. Every time a client has to can call a member of their family. They have to go through these body and cavity searches, that they're kept in solitary confinement. They're shackled when they're taken into the shower. I'm trying to reconcile these two very different visions of how prisoners are being treated. And these are the prisoners, apparently, you know, probably some of the Yemenis that we have been talking about. I'm trying to reconcile these two pictures.
Yeah, they're completely reconcilable in that the detainees, up until the appointment of the new commander of the base and until this hunger strike, which are related circumstances, were treated with in the ways that I describe in that piece. And the reason I mentioned it was to just underscore something about both detention and trials at Guantanamo, which are assumed, because they're in military custody, to be so much harsher. But the reality is that since this change in affairs at Guantanamo, where they have a harsher commander in place, where the hunger strikes are really making an impact on the reputation of the United States worldwide, they are being treated, according to their lawyers, more and more harshly. All of these things that you referred to are new and were unexpected, and it's punitive, and this is a new turn at Guantanamo.
But can't the president say to the new commander at Guantanamo, cut it out?
Yes.
I mean, why doesn't he do that?
Tully, do you have an answer for that?
You have an answer for that,
you
Cully?
You seem to be on a roll. Go ahead, Karen.
No, look, the president could, even without anybody knowing, say this needs to stop. Right. I think they don't know what to do about this hunger strike. They've had 4 or 5 hunger strikes in the past, 2 of them rather large, 1 in 2002, 1 in 2005. They've always lingered as a threat that the detainees would have. They are so frustrated about what to do. Can you imagine the consequences of detainees starting to die? It puts the administration in an untenable situation.
Well, I can imagine it.
Because I was
in charge of detainee policy when the first 3 detainees did die at Guantanamo. And, you know, for your readers, for your listeners' sake, hunger strikes have happened in lower numbers almost always at Guantanamo. And the detainees themselves certainly have the right to protest politically and complain that they're being held, and they've done that. And one of the forms of protest is to not eat. Some do it for a couple days, some do it for a couple hours, some do it longer. And eventually, when a doctor decides that it's dangerous for them, then he recommends that they be fed involuntarily. But I think that the answer to your question, Marty, is sure the president could do that. I think he would get strong pushback from the commander of Southern Command, a 4-star, and then the JTF commander down at Gitmo, a 1-star, because those people will say words to the effect, this is being driven by them, not us, and we're trying to do it to keep them safe. And this is an ongoing conversation that happens.
Well, let me just say, even if they didn't treat them in these punitive ways, and if they weren't instituting things that they're justifying in their minds for a variety of reasons, it wouldn't change the fact that these detainees, what do they actually want? In the past, and Cully, you can speak to this, in the past they've had specific things they've wanted. Sometimes it's communication with their families. Sometimes it's living in, camp X, one camp instead of the other camp. So it's, access to reading materials, whatever it is.
Go ahead, Karen.
Now what they want, it seems to be, is they actually want to die. And the reason is, one of the reasons is, when you clear 86 individuals for release, and some of them have been there for 10 plus years, and you say to them, you are going home, and then they find out that actually that's not the case. Being cleared for release means nothing. Then there is no sense of anything they could want. And I think that this may very much distinguish it from your time there. At least in my mind, it doesn't. I mean, you referred to it as protest. I see it as giving up. Well, so how do you see that?
Well, and hold on. Let me just toss something in here. And then, Cully, I do want to hear from you. And this is from one of the hunger strikers, apparently had a piece in The Guardian earlier this spring. And this is, his name is Shukr Amer. I hope I'm not.
Shukr Amer.
He says, as of today, and this was a month or so ago, I've spent more than 11 years in Guantanamo Bay. To be precise, it's been 4,084 long days and nights. I have never been charged with any crime.
Well, of course not. He doesn't need to be charged with a crime. He's a law war detainee. We detain people during wartime. That's a separate issue. But to Karen's point about...
How is that a separate... I mean, here's someone...
There's two bodies of law. On the one hand, you have due process, courts, speedy trial, juries, the rest of it. On the other hand is a very distinguished and long-standing body of law called the Law of Armed Conflict or the Law of War, which the Geneva Conventions and other international treaties recognize that a country at war may detain the enemy for the duration of the hostilities. And the fact that you don't know when the hostilities are going to end doesn't magically convert that to a right to a trial. That's all.
But if, I mean, I don't know if he's innocent or not, but if he's an innocent person and he's been held for 11 years and we're in, at least so far, a war without end, he could spend another 11 years at Guantanamo?
Well, he is being held at the discretion of the executive, the commander-in-chief. And if the commander-in-chief today decided that Shocker Armor should go home, mm-hmm. Then he would need to spend the political capital necessary to make that happen. And to date, I mean, here's the irony. I believe that when President Obama signed those executive orders shortly after taking office, he very much meant to close Guantanamo within the year he ordered it to be closed. And everyone got their expectations up that it would happen, including the detainees. And then when it didn't close, and it didn't close, and it didn't close, and he refused or didn't spend the political capital to make it happen within the first two-year window, people get despondent. They get sad. They become suicidal. They do the things that the detainees in Guantanamo are doing. So I don't doubt that they are in desperate straits.
Well, and just to add something, Karen, these Yemenis were cleared for being sent home or released for transfer, and then the so-called underwear bomber, the situation, I guess that was late 2009, attempted bombing of a jetliner in Detroit, and those releases were put on a moratorium.
Right. I mean, one thing that became clear in the speech to me, and he mentioned it twice, the underwear bomber, is the impact that had on the president. Because the way he described it really changed his thinking about release. And he was the one that instituted the moratorium on sending them back home. Remember, it's not just Yemenis that are left there. So we're talking about our larger group. And the question is, why doesn't he do what Cully Stimson referred to, which is work with the Secretary of Defense mm-hmm. to sign off on the others that have been cleared for release that are not Yemenis. And so it's stalled on a lot of levels, not just Yemen.
But what you're saying, Karen, is that there is a procedure in place to look at each of these prisoners individually and then make a determination about their readiness for release?
There has been a procedure going on since the beginning of the Obama administration. I believe if you ask them to describe their detainee policy, they would say it's a one-by-one policy. They've looked already at each one of these individuals, these 86 individuals. They've looked at their cases. They've determined that they can go back to their country or to a third country. Congress, in the meantime, has passed a bill, which the authorization for the National Defense Authorization
NDAA,
Act.
Right.
The NDAA, the most recent one, in which they have said that the Secretary of Defense will have to sign off on a whole bunch of assurances about these people going back and not returning to terrorism, which is, as Cully referred to earlier on, a very high bar. Who can predict that? So that's where we stand.
And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And we have a lot of callers that want to join our conversation as well. We are talking about the future of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the 166 detainees being held there, talking with Cully Stimson and Karen Greenberg, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Medford Lees, a Quaker-related community for those age 55-plus, proudly supports WHYY. On Saturday, June 1st, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Medford Lees and the Medford Arts Center presents Paint Our Gardens Plein Air Contest. Painters of all ages are invited to share their vision of a recognizable site within Medford Lee's 165-plus acres arboretum, abound with meadows, wetlands, and waterways. Full details and registration information at artsinmedford.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how opioid painkillers came to be used in the treatment of chronic pain, like back problems, and what the consequences have been. We talk with New York Times reporter Barry Meyer, author of the new e-book, A World of Hurt, Fixing Pain Medicine's Biggest Mistake. And John Powers tells us about his favorite films at the Cannes Film Festival. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The real estate market is hot in Phoenix, cold in Cleveland. Why? Also, the IRS is more maligned than ever, but the late David Foster Wallace found inspiration in the bureaucracy and put the tax agency at the heart of his last unfinished novel. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. And just to recap what we've been talking about, last week, President Obama renewed his pledge to close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In a wide-ranging speech about U.S. counterterrorism policy, he said he would lift the moratorium on the transfer of 56 prisoners back to Yemen, and he called on Congress to lift restrictions on transferring the remaining prisoners to the United States. The closing of Gitmo has faced congressional opposition from both parties. We're talking about the future of the facility and its prisoners with Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University, and Cully Stimson is a manager of the National Security Law Program at the Heritage Foundation, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Just a reminder to our listeners, according to what the president said last week, it costs $1 million a year per prisoner at Guantanamo. Let me see what Isabel from Andorra has to say. Isabel, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm Isabel Woodrow.
Yes.
And I'm not used to talking this way on the telephone.
Well, go
or
ahead.
Or on the radio. But at any rate, as I understand it, we have something like 156 detainees at Guantanamo, and no state wants to take them if convicted. Now, that if that is the case, what I'm suggesting is we prorate these prisoners among the 50 states. We put about $1 million along with every prisoner. That $1 million is for that prisoner's care and discipline. Then we make these credits, we make it a credit arrangement, where, like in New Jersey, where they have for the low-income housing, one township can buy it from another.
Well, Isabel, let me just stop you there, because, and I want to toss this to Karen Greenberg, we do have these supermax prisons, and the president said last week that no one has ever escaped from a supermax. Is that where some of these convicted terrorists are?
Yes, the majority of them is in the most well-known prison for this, which is in Colorado, in the supermax part of the Colorado prison. And yes, the president was right. We don't have terrorists escaping from our prisons. I think the idea, I just want to speak to the caller's point, because I think it's, there's two things about it that are really wonderful to think about. And the first is that what the president never considered early on was breaking up the detainee population. He kept it as an entity, and as a result, I think it was one of the first mistakes in trying to dismantle it, because Guantanamo as a reality exists, and it will exist into the future no matter where you move them, if you keep this group together and you keep them in indefinite detention. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is the idea of coming up with remedies is the fact that a listener can come up with a remedy, and that there seem to be so few remedies coming out of the rest of us and out of our government officials, has been one of the real problems. It's just a lack of creative solutions for this, whatever they are.
Well, Isabel, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Cully Stimson a chance to respond to that. And even picking up on what Karen said, the idea of keeping all these detainees together, I mean, does it make sense to disperse them? Would that change their status in any way?
To Ms. Woodrow's suggestion, dividing the 166 up among the 50 states,
right,
That is a creative idea. It won't work, with all due respect to her. One, because they're not convicted of crimes, and I think she was assuming they were convicted. But secondly, states, representatives and senators don't want a campaign on importing terrorists from Guantanamo into their state, so politically it's unfeasible. Some might, but most wouldn't. But let me touch on something Karen said,
sure.
And that is the lack of creativity. I agree and I don't disagree. I agree in the sense that doesn't appear to the outside world that there's been a lack of creativity, and it appears that they sort of treat them all together. I can tell you, having worked inside the system, that very creative people have tried to think of very creative ways. For example, the Uyghurs, the Chinese Muslim extremists who were essentially mercenary fighters, they were treated differently. They were cleared eventually by the courts, and we got the first Uyghurs off the island, and they went to Albania. The next group in the Obama administration went to Bermuda. And so we have looked at them differently. In fact, the big three populations at Gitmo were the Saudis, the Yemenis, and the Afghans. And we treated the Afghans differently than the Saudis, and the Saudis differently than the Yemenis, because the Afghans and the Saudis had programs in their countries where they could reintegrate them back into a system. And that has happened. Mm-hmm. That has already happened. And I think, to Karen's point, this last group may be, but I don't know because I'm not inside the system anymore, may be looked at more as a group versus individual, but I doubt it.
Well, and I wonder, Karen, if we're talking, we've been focusing largely on these 56 Yemenis, whether there is, I mean, we know things are a little unstable in Yemen these days. I mean, are there programs to monitor them or to sort of see what happens to them if and when they get returned to Yemen?
I mean, I think the concern about Yemen is that it's an unstable country fraught with violence that is somewhat tribal, certainly factional. And how do you deposit individuals who you suspect may want to turn to terrorism or to return to terrorism? And in this case, not because they've been cleared. But how do you account for this to the American people? What I would say in response to that are two things. One, the rehabilitation programs that Cully Stimson referred to, somehow that idea seems to have disappeared. And so maybe not Yemeni rehabilitation, maybe Saudi or some other place. So that's one possibility. But there still is the problem of where exactly they're going to reside after that. Part of this reluctance on the part of other countries and reluctance on part of the United States comes not just from instability of other countries, but the failure of leadership in the United States to take any of these detainees. We're asking the rest of the world to take them, to integrate them, to watch them. In terms of returning people to Yemen or other unstable countries, we have spent untold billions of dollars in the past 10 years building up what Cully referred to as our intelligence capacity, our way of going about counterterrorism without military might necessarily. It seems to me at this point we have to rely on that. And so this would be collaborative, watchful, law enforcement and intelligence efforts to monitor those who were abroad in case they returned to terrorism.
But would it be fair to say, Cully, that a number of these detainees have been radicalized because of their detention?
I know that charge is made. I know that some detainees who have been released claim that they weren't radicalized when they first got there. They were innocent little sheep herders, and then as a result of being around bad people at Guantanamo, they turned. I don't know that to be true, so I can't comment one way or the other. But to Isabel's other point about no countries want them, that's actually quite the opposite. The Yemeni government has been asking for the Yemeni detainees in Guantanamo for years. When I was there, they were more than happy to take them all back. They just didn't have any programs in place that could mitigate the threat that some of them posed. And to Karen's point about the program, for example, in Saudi Arabia, putting the Yemeni detainees there, people probably don't really think about this, but the Yemenis, the Afghans, and the Saudi detainees at Guantanamo, they didn't like each other. We had to keep them apart from each other. The Saudis looked down on the Yemenis and the Afghans as inferiors. And so I don't think, based on what I've known when I was in the Pentagon and what I've heard since then, that it would really be a good fit to send the Yemenis through the Saudi program.
Let me see what Greg from Vincenttown, New Jersey, has to say. Greg, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to throw in maybe a curveball here to get at some more, get at the problem at a more basic level. It seems to me that what we're really concerned about is the risk that these people pose if they're somehow released, whether it's by us or by the Yemenis or however they get out. We're afraid that there's still a risk to society, and what we're looking for is a way to justify holding on to them. And a thought occurs to me that if someone has a belief that is telling them that they have to kill people, that verges on a psychological problem, and perhaps if we looked at this as if these were people who had profound psychological problems, it would give us a theory that would allow us to hold on to them until they're judged to be no longer a risk, take a parole approach to them as opposed to the approaches that have been thought of so far.
Well, Greg, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Another a provocative question, Karen, but can you hold someone because of their belief system?
In theory, no, but it depends on what they've done with those beliefs and where we draw the line to action. But I just want to address something that Greg raised, which is this psychological rehabilitation or psychological intervention. That was one of the prongs of the Saudi rehabilitation program that was used for some of these detainees. It was a mixture of a religious training psychological intervention and other supportive mechanisms to help reintegrate them in what was considered to be a constructive way back into society.
And did it work largely? Do you know?
Depends on who you ask. There are reports that say that, 10 or so of the individuals that went through the program found a way back into wanting to support or enact terrorism, particularly in Yemen. Other people would say that those are overblown statistics. But again, we know it's so hard to make judgments about this because we just don't have the facts, and it's just a lot of differing opinions.
Now, Greg, thanks for the call. Let me get Alex from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Alex, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was wondering that since these detainees are being held in our names, if journalists shouldn't be allowed to have access to them to tell their stories and also to find out the impact that our policies are having on their families, wherever they are, because these are kind of nameless individuals, it'd be good for us to know what's happening in our names, and also perhaps the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and the World Court might get involved to help move it along.
Well, Alex, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Collie Stimson, you want to take that?
Sure. Journalists have contacted detainees who've been released or transferred, and over the years interviewed their families. Some detainees have written books and gone on a roadshow talking about their treatment. The Tipton 3 from England have done that. Others have done that. European parliamentarians have been to Guantanamo. Of course, they weren't allowed to speak to the detainees, nor are our congressmen or senators. And the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, at least two, maybe three, Karen can correct me, have filed reports about Guantanamo, and they have not been able to speak to the detainees. Now, the entity that does speak to the detainees, besides their lawyers, is the International Committee of the Red Cross, which during wartime is the appropriate entity for confidential humanitarian communications between the detainee and their families, and that has been ongoing since the beginning of the camps.
Karen, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I want to say that the point that these detainees are nameless is essential point to understanding how troubling and destructive the Guantanamo issue is. The fact is that we have all of these detainees, there were nearly 800 in total at one point, that these individuals are not known to us. And you have an op-ed in the New York Times or an op-ed in other places that talk about their pain and their legitimate desire to be either tried or released, or at least charged, that we don't know who these individuals are. And journalists have been kept away from them, and political figures have been kept away from them. As Cully said, the people that have had contact with them are their lawyers. And as a result, their lawyers have come under a great deal of scrutiny, of mistreatment, many would say, but they are the only access we have to getting a sense of these individuals being human beings. This is what's so important about the hunger strike. It's the detainees finding a way to let the world know that they're actually people. And in all of this policy talk and all of this debate, we often lose sight of that because we have nothing to grab onto.
Cully, do they have a right to legal counsel?
Oh, yeah, they do. And in fact, if Alex is bored, he can go on to the district court here in the District of Columbia's website or the D.C. Circuit's website and read the opinions in the habeas cases. Now, they're dry, boring, legal mumbo-jumbo, even for lawyers who want to wade through it, but it does sort of talk about the legal aspects of whether they fit the definition of an unprivileged belligerent, which is the standard for that the government has to maintain for them to be held. And they can read those opinions. So, I mean, that really is the most visible aspect of their presence at Guantanamo. But people don't typically go to that website and read district and circuit court opinions.
And we're almost out of time here. Karen, are we going to have you and Cully Stimson back in 5 years to talk about the closure of Guantanamo?
No, they're going to figure it out in the next little while.
A little while meaning what? Within the next year?
Yeah, I think they're going to figure it out. I think they've done. I want to believe this, and I actually think it's possible.
Do you think it's possible, Cully?
Yes, I absolutely think it's possible. Whether they're going to spend the political capital and make the hard decisions is an open question.
Well, on that that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Cully Stimson, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
And Karen Greenberg, thank you very much as well.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Karen Greenberg, Director of the Center on National Security, that's at Fordham University, and Charles Stimson, Manager of the National Security Law Program at the Heritage Foundation. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can learn much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email, the archives, podcasts, Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.